Hello, episode 5. What is this called? I Seem Fun, the Diary of Jen Kirkman podcast. Hello, everybody. Oh my God, this is a milestone that we're about to hit together as listener and podcaster. I have my first retractions and corrections to make. So I think I said at the end of last episode that I was doing the Wilco Solid Sound Festival in September. It is in June. I knew it was in June, but my mouth said September. I must have had September on my mind. Perhaps I was thinking that if I ever attend a wedding again, I really don't need to hear the song September. Ba-na-na, ba-na-na, da-na-na-na-na. You think you like it, and then like 30 seconds later, you're like, I've hit my limit of hearing this song. It's not a bad song. It's just that people won't stop playing it in social situations, and there's always a social situation. That's not even true. Is there always one? Who cares? The point is, I had September on the brain. So the Solid Sound Festival is in June in North Adams, Massachusetts. Of course, you went to my website, and you saw the info there anyway. You didn't just tweet at me, come to Folsom Prison, which isn't a place anymore, but jenkirkman.com, tour dates, you'll see everything there. It's going to be a really great show. No, I am not playing with Wilco. I was in Wilco years ago. They kicked me out because I went rogue with a tambourine, but I'm doing, luckily we're still on good terms and they're letting me do the comedy portion of their festival, which is on a Saturday, June 22nd or 4th, whatever the closest to that date is. Again, go to my website. It's myself, John Hodgman, who's curating it. Reggie Watts, Al Madrigal. It's going to be great. Okay, that's my first retraction. Now that is a plug retraction. Now we're getting into the show. Okay, so you might remember episode 3, where I talked about my high school, middle school friend told my dentist that he didn't think my material was acceptable. Now, this isn't the former punk rock one. This is the just like eighth grade friend of mine. I texted my best girlfriend from childhood and said, can you believe that Scotty didn't think this was appropriate? She texts me back the next day. I told Scotty. Why did she do that? I don't know. I think it's funny. And Scotty emailed me and said, Jen, I loved your show. How would I have been able to face you afterwards and hang out with you if I didn't like it? In fact, I loved it. I think it's great. I think you're funny. I don't have any problem with you talking about the subjects that you talk about. And he's like, it was the dentist, your old dentist, who said he didn't think it was appropriate and he didn't think it was funny. Whew. I mean, if you can only imagine what a semi-loop I was thrown for 4 seconds. But then I called my mom. Jennifer, everyone is lying to you. Who is going to tell you the truth? Me? Or some kid that's trying to save face? Your dentist loved it. He's very progressive and he knows what's good. I'm telling you, these people are lying to you because they don't want it. They want to stay in your good graces. As if I'm like, as if they're the Memphis Mafia and I'm Elvis and they want to, I won't get a Cadillac from Miss Kirkman this month if I don't stay in her good graces. This kid doesn't owe me anything. I'm not going to see him again. I saw him once this year. And then the last time I saw him, I think was 1989. So, you know, I think he honestly, I don't know. I actually don't know who I believe. I feel like maybe my dentist is a sociopath. You know, you might have to be a little screwed up to be a dentist. You put your fingers in people's mouths, you drill. You know, there's no way he doesn't feel the vibration in his arms of the drill. And that would make me crazy. That doesn't seem to bother him. So maybe he didn't like it and he's spreading rumors about other people. So maybe he lies to my mom. And then when Scotty comes in, he's like, oh, I know it was awful. Who knows? Not mine to know. As that sounds almost like it's a spiritual expression. Not mine to know, but that's not a real expression. But anyway, so, you know, the mystery will remain in Needham, Massachusetts. I probably shouldn't give out towns and locations of dentists and childhood friends and my parents. Everyone be cool. Don't do anything weird to Needham, Massachusetts. Okay. Oh, and then the other retraction is episode 4. I mentioned that my grandmother's cousin painted a painting of a hot Jesus, and my mother had told me that he killed his wife, was deeply religious, but was in prison. My mom called me. I guess my mom is listening to the podcast. We didn't even really get into it. I just called her. She goes, I've got a few corrections. So I guess she's listening. Hi, mom, if you're listening. It's amazing. A 74-year-old woman, they have a computer that literally sounds like somebody's oxygen machine isn't working. It's like when you turn it on. And she's figuring out podcasts. I guess she must stream it. I don't think they have iTunes. And she can't use an iPhone. I've tried to show her how to take a picture. I don't have these modern things. So anyway, but I guess it was my grandfather's cousin who was responsible for the Jesus painting. And as my mother said, he wasn't Catholic. He was German. Although we're Catholic and German, so I don't understand why he wasn't. But who cares, right? There's a certain line in my family. On my mom's side, my grandfather's German. My grandmother that married him was not. She was French-Canadian. And she loved to hold his being German against him as though he was Hitler. He's German. So anyway, so here's the correction on that. It was indeed my grandfather's cousin who did not paint the painting of Hot Jesus. He made the frame. His inmate friend painted the picture of Hot Jesus. And some woman in the family gave it to my parents as a wedding present. Hey, here's a picture of Jesus. Have a happy marriage. Hope it didn't end in death and prison like the man who framed this painting. That was the other thing my mom said. He was in prison for killing his wife, but he found her in bed with another man, and so he shot her dead. Like, I don't think she meant it like so. Well, you can understand. I also picture that he shot her while she was in bed, and he was a really good aim, and he just shot her and then just turned to the guy and was like, no, you're cool, dude. So what's up? You want to get lunch or help me hide the body or what's going on? I don't understand why the guy didn't get shot too. You'd think you would want to take something away from the guy that put his penis in your wife. You know, you think you would at least shoot him in the dick, right? Show him, you like doing that to my wife? Boom, you're not doing that anymore. That's actually more satisfying than killing his wife. I know his point is, if I can't have you to myself, then I don't want you to live. But I think murderers should rethink that. And you should just shoot the dick off everyone who tries to come in contact with your wife. It'll scare your wife enough that she might stop cheating, first of all. You might only have to shoot one dick in your lifetime. And secondly, no one gets killed. And, someone has to put some ice on their crotch for a while. It's a better solution. We're not going to get rid of guns, right? We're not going to cure murderous rages caused by love. And we're not going to cure infidelity. But we can curb murder by being more practical about how we handle our violent outrage over, and jealousy. Anyway, so those are my retractions. There's a dentist mystery. And my grandfather's cousin shot his wife, got out of prison, my mom says, on good behavior. Which is, of course you're going to behave while in prison. No one in there is fucking your wife. You're not confronted with the same moral dilemmas. You can't reach for a gun in prison. So, of course you have good behavior. But I guess, I'm sure the justice system knows what it's doing. This is not a socio-political podcast. So God bless the jails of Walpole State Prison, I believe. Shout out to my prisoners in Walpole. Hope you guys are behaving. Okay. So this week I wanted to talk about drugs and alcohol. And I don't know why, because I don't really have a relationship with either substance. But I was just thinking, I really have never done a drug in my life. Now mom is listening. She knows I smoked pot. She knows I tried pot in college. And it's so funny because I think in my mom's mind, pot, and I used to think this too in high school, I thought pot was a gateway drug. I thought you couldn't get enough of something. I didn't understand the psychology of gateway drug because, they say things to you when you're a kid. And I understand the concept that if you do anything for any amount of time, you get used to it, right? Even your body gets used to antibiotics. So if you're a sickly person who's always taking antibiotics, you're going to keep getting sick every year because you're actually not building up your own immunity. So I understand, chemically how if you smoke pot a lot, like maybe you have to smoke a little more eventually to get high. Or perhaps if you might crave a different kind of high, a more mellow thing, maybe you'll look for some oxycodone or something. But I don't really think that's true, because I think it depends on the mental makeup of the person. Like, I drink wine and I have a glass and I can put it down at a glass and I love the nice warm buzz it gives me. I can drink four glasses of wine and get tipsy, but I'm not the next day fiending for something stronger. Or even years later, I've been drinking responsibly for almost 20 years now, and I've never wanted a harder hit or whatever. So I don't really think there's a lot of validity to gateway drugs, but even if there was, I think it means over time. And when I was growing up, I thought it meant that second, that if you tried pot, the next day you're on heroin, the third day you're Michael Jackson and on an anesthesia machine. Like, I really didn't know, like, how soon does the gate make way on the gateway? So I was just like, I'm going to stay away from everything because I don't know how it works. And, you know, there was no internet. There was no, I didn't have any, you know, I knew that, you know, my sisters, they don't like me talking about it, but they're older than me and they went to high school in the 70s. Draw your own conclusions. I'm sure they had some pot in their life. And I remember hearing vague things in the house, my mother and father telling them, don't smoke pot, don't smoke pot. And I would picture, because when I used to give myself home facials when I was 8, because I was very concerned with always looking young, because I knew, or I wasn't right, but I thought someday I would be like a Vegas showgirl or some kind of a movie actress, but like old time movie actress, the type of thing that doesn't exist anymore. So I used to love in the movies when they put like cold cream on their face. I think I maybe saw that in All About Eve. And I would boil water on the stove in a pot, and then when it got steamy, put a towel over my head and steam my face when I was 8. So when I heard my parents telling my sisters not to smoke pot, I was wondering why they didn't tell me that, because I thought, I am smoking pot. I'm putting my face over this steam on the stove. So that's what I thought smoking pot was. Then I figured out it probably means something different, but I wasn't sure. And then I remember in third grade, this was 1983, the trend was to wear a braided silky headband, very thin though, to wear it, you know, to hold your bangs back. But I had, you know, I loved classic rock and I had a Jimi Hendrix album. And I think I saw a picture of Jimi Hendrix where he had the headband across his forehead. So I started wearing my headband like that to be different, to be like Jimi Hendrix. And I got in third grade called into the principal's office and they said, your headband is not appropriate. And I said, why? And they said, you can, I really don't remember what they said exactly, but they said it's a drug thing. That Jimi Hendrix used to do drugs that way. I said, what do you mean? They said he used to hide drugs in his headband. And I said, but I'm not hiding drugs in my headband. And they said, it gives a signal that you're a druggie. But I'm like, I'm 8. So later in life, I don't remember, but I found out that the rumor was that Jimi Hendrix would put acid tabs in his headband so it would soak in through the sweat in his forehead. That, right? Is that the rumor we all heard? Am I hearing it wrong? It's probably something totally different. But that, I think, is what my teachers had heard. And then they told me to take the headband off, but they wouldn't even tell me the drug rumor so as not to give me ideas, I guess. But I was so sad. I was like, I think this looks cool. What is this? What do you mean it's a drug thing? So then in sixth grade, I wanted to be just like this girl, Nikki. And she had these really cool fuzzy things that she clipped onto her purse and they just hung off and she would clip them together. And I just loved it. And so I asked for some for Christmas. And I didn't know what they were called. And then my older sister was like, those are called roach clips. And I was like, oh, okay. So I put on my Christmas list roach clips. And then I think I got in trouble because it turns out that roach clips are clips to hold the roach of your joint, which is the last couple puffs so that you don't burn your finger, which I had no idea what that is. And I've still never seen a roach clip used as that. I only saw a slutty girl in sixth grade use it to decorate her purse. And I thought it looked cool. And then, oh, I think Nikki was copying Angie, who was an eighth grader. And Angie looked like an Angie. She looked like someone you write a song about, someone that breaks up a band. Eyeliner on the inside of her eye, feathered hair way past the feathered hair expiration date and, you know, skirts so short that her long leather jacket over it made her look like she wasn't wearing pants. She was badass. So I think we were all like imitations of Angie, but I wasn't allowed to obviously even dress that way. But I never did a drug in my life. I never drank in high school. I never took a sip. I think my dad gave me a sip of beer when I was 7. I remember because whenever I don't like beer, but if I have the first sip of a Heineken, it was a Coors Light. I know. Yes. My dad gave me a sip of Coors Light, or maybe he didn't give me a sip. Maybe I turned away. Maybe when he turned away, I took a sip. But I always had this good control thing where I took a sip and I was like, yummy, that tastes good. And I feel a little hot right now. Like my face feels hot. But okay, I don't need to do that. That's what grownups do. I'll do it later. Like I just never thought about it again. And I know the other people, that's like their AA story. They're like, the first sip made me feel normal. And then I went off into the world and drank. And I'm like, I could take it or leave it. But I had the little, every time I have like the first sip of a beer, it feels really good. And then it feels too watery and I feel bloated. So I put it down. So I'm kind of like that with everything. I'm like, I like a first kiss and then I'm like, all right, I'm bored. You know, I like a first of everything. But not the kind of first where people have to keep doing the same thing over and over, chasing the same high. I know you won't get it. So I don't even bother wasting my time. But what was my point about that beer? Oh, drink. I didn't even have a drink in high school. My mom would not let me go to my friends' houses after school because their moms worked. My mom worked, but her hours were compatible with me coming home from school. So I couldn't go to my friend Terry's house because her mom worked. But I'm like, we're not drinking. We're like making mixtapes in her room and talking about boys. I was like, no. But I do remember one night Terry had a sleepover. We slept in the basement and we found her parents, Bartles and James, wine coolers, which is so funny now because that seemed so grown up. But her parents were probably, we were 16. Her parents were probably 38, which is my age. I wouldn't have Bartles and James wine coolers in my place. Like, I almost feel bad for her parents. Like, why was that their sophistication level of alcohol? But I think we all opened one and passed it around. And I think to be funny, I, quote, got wasted. Like, I clearly couldn't have been if I had, like, 3 sips. But I just pretended I was wasted. And they believed me. And then I was like, that was a lot of work. And then I just never felt like drinking again. And then, because I was so afraid of getting in trouble and drinking, I just decided I was straight edge. Which is like, you know, a punk rock movement. The people put the X's on their hands. And Henry Rollins was straight edge. And that was what I decided. I didn't listen to that music necessarily. I think there's punk rock that girls like that sounds more like 50s music sped up. And then there's like Black Flag, which I enjoy-ish, but it's more of a dude thing. And then I got into Riot Girl later. But I said, oh, I'm straight edge. Like, instead of just saying, I'm afraid my mom's going to yell at me if I drink and I don't know how to smoke pot, I'm afraid I would look stupid doing it. And Nancy Reagan said, just say no. And then I keep hearing about this gateway. Like, I couldn't say that. So I had to make it a thing. Just like when I knew I didn't know how to do sex, I made it a thing. I'm celibate like Morrissey. I'm celibate. But it's like, I'm not celibate. My boobs haven't developed yet. I mean, you know, I had my first kiss when I was 14. I'd actually had a kiss earlier in 6th grade at a sleepover camp, but I don't count that because it was spin the bottle and some kid just like got all tonguey and I was like, get away, get away. And then he called me the next morning or the next week. It was as a 1-weekend sleepaway thing. I wasn't allowed to go to sleepaway camps, but it was the next weekend he called me on a Saturday morning and I'm like, I'm watching Pee-wee's Playhouse. Like, don't call me at 10:30. It was, I think I was in 11 or something. But then my real kiss, when it's like a boy asked me out and we went to my friend's house and we sat and watched Saturday Night Live in the basement and then he kissed me. That was my first kiss. But I was like, oh my God, please don't go up my shirt. Like, I didn't even have an opinion about if I wanted a boy to go up my shirt or even a sexual feeling. I was just like, I'm flat chested. He's going to be so disappointed. I wish I had the attitude then that I do now. Like, you're lucky to even be here, dude. Not because I think I'm so great, but just everyone who is getting any action is lucky. So if you're going to complain about someone's body, buzz off, you know? And I'm sorry to use such strong language like buzz off. I'm going to have to put an explicit rating on this now, but I didn't even want him to touch my boobs. So then I go to his house, right? All we do is make out for like a week. And I can tell he's getting a little antsy. Like maybe he wants something more to happen, you know? I think he would have been fine if I said, I'm not going to go further, but I just never said anything. And then one time I was kissing him in his basement and my dad walked in, my dad walked in to this guy's basement and, was just like, Jennifer, get home. Like he drove by this guy's house that he didn't want me to be dating and saw my bike outside. And of course I should have brought the bike inside. He like basically lived in his mom's basement. It was dirty. Like I couldn't bring a bike in there. I should have brought the bike in. My dad never would have known. But anyway, I wanted to yell at my dad, nothing's going on because I don't have boobs yet. You don't understand. I'm embarrassed on 10 levels now. So anyway, that guy ended up dumping me only because it was too difficult to get a date with me because my parents were always, you know, dragging me out. So, but then I got boobs later and wasn't sure if I was supposed to do anything with them. Like no one teaches you this, like guys like boobs, but like, I think they just like them, you know, it's like, but when you're 15, 16, you're like, am I supposed to do something with them? Like put my hands underneath and go like bunga, bunga, bunga and like excite them. Or I think, you know, now I know, but, and the answer is yes, ladies do that. I'm kidding. But you know, when you're 16, you're just like, okay, now I have the boobs, but I'm still not sure like what's going to happen if he sees them. Like, I don't want to be bad at this. So then I was just like, forget it. I'm celibate. And that ended, you know, a couple of years later, but I, that was definitely a stance that I took. And so I didn't really drink again until college. And then I didn't know how to drink. Like, I honestly didn't know how much you were supposed to drink. Like we would buy those terrible jugs of vodka that I can see the label. It's like gold and red, but it's, you know, probably $4.99. And I would just pour like that into, you know, like an 8-ounce glass, like pour it halfway up and then add some cranberry juice. Like I thought that was a normal size drink. No one taught me. I never bartended. You know, your parents aren't going to go, if you're going to drink, you know, use a shaker and a little measuring cup. So I would just drink that and then throw up. But that's not like problem drinking. That's literally like, God, I guess every time you drink, you throw up. Like, how come my parents were never throwing up at, you know, at Thanksgiving? I guess, maybe I'm allergic to this. So I just kind of laid off the vodka because I was like, I guess I'm not doing this right. And then I tried pot in college and you don't understand how afraid I was until I realized, and this is what, you know, someone like my mom or my parents' generation is never going to realize is, it is not a gateway drug. And when you're sitting around the nerdiest people, you know, they're in your theater class, you know, they make masks for fun, you know, like paper mache masks with feathers on them. And they talk about Commedia dell'arte. Is it dell'arte or dell'arte? I'm sure you'll tell me. Anyway, you're sitting around with these people and they have like, you know, they're just wearing like the type of people that I always thought anyone who wears their keys around their neck on a rope, like their dorm key, is like a dork, you know, and they're watching like Blind Melon videos. And it's like the least scary people. Like you're not in an alley with Sid Vicious. You're in a dorm room that's very safe. That's 10 miles from home, or at least for me it was. And some guy with glasses and long hair and his keys around his neck passes you a bong. And says, this is actually better for your lungs. I know you have a tendency towards asthma. I mean, that's like the dorkiest that it gets. And then you try it and it's like, I didn't feel anything. And I think I am immune to pot. And don't write me letters. I'm not interested in, pot is not something I'm interested in. And my friends who smoke pot say that they like it because they feel different every time. That's not a Jen Kirkman thing. I need to know exactly how I'm going to feel at all times. I did have a friend, saying, well, maybe you need to try prescription marijuana, but there's no need to try it because I don't need it for anything. But it just isn't my vibe. So, but my mom, I think, was very upset when she found out I smoked pot. And whose parent wouldn't be who doesn't understand that stuff? But I never like did pills recreationally. I never tried cocaine, never tried ecstasy, never tried anything. I guess when I say I've never tried a drug, I don't have to list all of them because I just think of drugs. But I will tell you that the cocaine thing, Here's my thing. I understand a drug addict who's like, I'm not even feeling anymore. I can't stop. Or someone who's like, I don't care if I die. I'm semi, you know, have a death wish or whatever. But the people who love their life, who use drugs to party because they feel so good, that's what I don't get. That's what I'm like, yeah, but you could die. So this is like where I shouldn't call myself a big nerd. I don't think it's like cool to do drugs, but there is something cool about not being so calculated and not being so afraid. But I think it all stems for me from, now I might get some dates wrong, but I believe it was fifth grade, which was 1984, 1985. This is what I remember. Now you might be like, no, it was the Celtics off season. You couldn't have been in school, but this is what I remember is that the fifth graders, 10-year-old kids, right, were taken into the gymnasium at school. The school nurse and the gym teacher stood in front of us and said, Len Bias, one of the Boston Celtics, because I grew up in right outside of Boston. Len Bias, one of the Boston Celtics, died from doing cocaine. They didn't even say overdose, right? Which, you know, is a totally separate thing. Like an overdose is you do too much coke, right? They just said he died from doing coke. They said he tried it once and he dropped dead. And that's what happens when you do coke. And we were like, oh my God, that was way more effective. That was around the same years as Nancy Reagan's Just Say No. And I'd love to see some statistics about how she thinks she saved some kids from doing drugs with that, but it was really the Len Bias thing. So I guess the story is Len Bias was, I don't know sports, so I'm going to get all the words wrong. A college rookie. That's not even a thing. A college basketball player, right? That I know that, right? And he got scouted by the Celtics and they're like, he's going to save the team. His stats are like really good. I'm not even going to pretend I know stats. 4.0 to the 2.6. First of all, when guys talk to me about sports and I go, I loved the year the Red Sox won the World Series. It was really wonderful. They're like, yeah, but you don't know the IBS on the 2.9 of the free throw yard line. I'm like, but I don't want to sound like I have some kind of weird, you know, OCD where I read phone books. Like, can't I talk about how beautiful it was that it was this ragtag team of guys with long hair and Johnny Damon said, we're going to call ourselves the idiots and we're not going to care if we win or lose and we're just going to play. And the Yankees were beating them and beating them and beating them. And the Red Sox, the Yankees had won three games. There were seven games total that you play in the playoffs. The Yankees won three. So the Red Sox would have to win four in a row, which is impossible. You know, it's possible. It's happened. But it's Red Sox, Yankees. The morale is terrible. Even people in Boston are like, you're terrible. And the Red Sox won four in a row. And for the first time got into the World Series by beating the Yankees in the playoffs. It was a beautiful time in Boston history. And then they won the World Series. They swept it. They won four games in a row. Now, I know that. I know the information. I know that it was Big Poppy's home run in one of the games that did it. Why is that not enough for guys? They're like, yeah, but RBI to the 5-6 foul line. I'm like, why do you want to talk to me like I'm a dude? A cute girl says she liked the Red Sox game. You want to start yelling at me about numbers? Check yourself. Anyway. So I'm probably getting the details of Len Bias wrong, but he was some great white hope. He's black, but you know what I'm saying. Great white hope for the Celtics. And I guess like the night he got elected onto the team or there was some celebration party. All right, now I'm not even acting like I know what a party is. There was some celebration party and September was playing. Do you remember? Oh my God, someone just died of a cocaine overdose. He just tried it once. And it's like, okay. So we were terrified. So every time I never saw cocaine in my life. It didn't cross me in college. But anytime I heard about it, I was like, oh my God, that drug that can kill you immediately. And nobody knows. Nobody knows if they've got the heart attack. And I think now looking back on it, it's like they probably said that to scare us. But the media spin was probably this innocent kid tried coke once. And it's like the guy probably did coke all the time. And he probably did way too much one night because he was feeling cocky. And maybe he had some pre-existing heart condition. But come on. You know what I mean? I'm never going to do coke, but I bet I could. I was just going to say I bet I could do a tiny bit and be fine. And I couldn't even finish the sentence because I'm still convinced that I would be, even if Len Bias didn't just try it once and die, I'm convinced that's what I would happen to me. So that's good. They did their job. Parents, teachers of Needham, Massachusetts, you did your job. I have never tried cocaine. In fact, I was so afraid of drugs that I had an older friend in high school. He was a senior when I was a sophomore. And the freaky kids used to hang out at a gazebo on the outskirts of the football field. It was very visually poetic, right? So all these kids wearing black and combat boots, you know, they've got their boom boxes playing the Clash. We're all hanging out. I wasn't trying to describe, say anything, but that movie was accurate for a reason. It's not like, you know, so we're standing there. And then one of my friends walks across the football field towards the woods. And if you're doing that alone, I was like, where's he going? And they're like, oh, he's buying pot. And I'm like, oh my God, he's going to die. One of my best friends is going to die. And I was like crying. I got on the ground crying with my friend Heather. We were like, oh, he's going to die. Oh my God. I thought I knew him. And I think I called him that night and I'm like, I'm worried about you. Like I was trying to do some kind of weird intervention. And he was like, what? Like I'm 18 years old. I smoke pot. I can't explain it to you. And I was like, oh my God. He's like, I'm never going to offer it to you. It's not going to be in your world. And I was just like, I can't look at you the same. And he's like, well, you won't have to. I'm going to college and I'm a grown man and you're 14. But I was, now what was so weird is during this celibate and drug-free time, I smoked cigarettes. That was my one thing. And I think I drank coffee and smoked cigarettes. And that was sort of my, I don't know if I was being rebellious. I thought I was being intellectual. This is back when we used to hang out at this place called Bergson's, which had like literally a counter, you know, you could sit at, very 1950s. And we would all cram into a booth after school and drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. Now I had lessons every day, piano, tap, ballet, jazz, point, musical rehearsal. There was one day of the week that I didn't have a lesson. And that was the day that I sort of could get away with going somewhere after school, but I always had to say I was doing a thing. I'm going to study with whoever, or I'm going to a movie, but I would really just go to Bergson's and sit and drink coffee and talk with my friends and chain smoke. It was, again, I didn't know how much you smoked or how much you didn't. And then you would drive in a car and smoke with the windows up. I don't know how my parents didn't smell cigarette smoke on me, but I think it also was back in the day when really everywhere had smoking indoors. So you could end up going home smelling like you had smoked even if you hadn't. But I remember one night going out and just sitting in a booth and smoking cigarettes, nothing else. But because I had smoked too many, I came home and my mom opened the door and I threw up. And I was like, I'm not drunk. And I think she believed me. I think they knew, but then I think they found cigarettes in my room one night and I said they were my friends. And actually they were my friends. But my friend gave them to me because we would share the pack back and forth. So semi-lie, semi-truth. Anyway, I don't smoke either anymore because listen to my voice. But that's not from smoking. I've always sounded like this. But I even remember one time hanging out with some friends. I had made like some different friends my senior year in high school. I hung out with a couple like what I would call like normal people. And they wanted me to go to a party with them. So I got in the car and they said, oh, we should go to the golf course and drink first. And then someone said, no, this crazy greenskeeper guy has a gun and he comes out of his golf cart and he steals your beer. And I was like, that's my dad. Because my dad was the greenskeeper. And his favorite thing to do at night once the sun set was get on it wasn't a golf cart. It was a go buggy, like that thing Bill Murray drives in Caddyshack that he uses when he's driving to kill the gophers. My dad had one of those because that's what greenskeepers have. And so he would drive around the golf course looking to bust kids who were drinking. And when I was little, I would go with him thinking that was the most fun thing. And he'd put a spotlight on them and he'd fire like a flare gun. And then he would take their beer and then he would put it in the refrigerator in the maintenance garage. And I think, you know, his guys would drink it. So that was kind of the police attitude I had growing up, was like, let's bust these kids drinking on the golf course because they're going to ruin the greens. They're going to get drunk and they're going to run all over the greens. And my dad worked hard on those. So to me, it was like, I was not on the hooligan side of things. I was on the law's side. The only time in my life that I remember thinking, oh, I know how people get in trouble, is when I had my tonsils out at 21. And I guess it's like a big surgery when you're 21. For some reason, they say it's really dangerous. So they kept me in the hospital for 2 days. And that's a whole other story because my boyfriend, Brent, at the time, cute guy I went to college with was looked kind of like he was a character in Dazed and Confused, and would visit me by my side, hold my hand. Very dramatic. He was an actor. And my dad would be like, get out of here. Because I know my dad's head is just like, this guy's penis might be going into my daughter. Like, and then my dad said something nice about President Reagan, who wasn't even the president. And then Brent was like, he took food stamps away from my family. And I thought, oh, that was it. All hell broke loose. And he and my dad had a fight over my hospital bed. But I couldn't move or talk because I was just coming out of anesthesia. And the surgery is so severe in your throat that you're basically just swallowing blood and you're nauseous from anesthesia. So I was throwing up, but it was like ripping open my throat more, and they have to calm you down. And I couldn't take Percocet because I was on an empty stomach. And so they had to give me Demerol. Now, this is the other thing. I was so nervous before the operation. My dad said, they're going to give you anesthesia, so you're not even going to feel anything. But I said, but what do I do about this intense shaking, physical shaking my body is going through? What do I do about this before the anesthesia? And my dad just said to the nurse, can you give my daughter a little something? And she just goes, oh, sure. And just kind of fixes up my hand and sticks a needle in my hand of just like a nice, steady, slow drip of something real calming. And I was like, oh, I mean, it was instant. And it felt like cold ice water going through my veins. And I don't know what it was, but I was like, this feels great. And then I went under anesthesia and I was like, who cares, you know? And then I woke up from the anesthesia and I was kind of like, where's the nice cold drip feeling that feels good? And I think they gave me something. I was being hydrated. I don't remember, but, I wonder why I can't remember. But the pain was so bad and I couldn't swallow Percocet that they gave me Demerol every day, gave me Demerol shots in my bum, not like my butt, you know, like my butt cheek. And my parents would drive me to the local hospital every day to get my shots a couple times a day. And man, did that feel good. And I think, this is gross, but I think they gave me, do they make Demerol suppositories? I think they gave me something in that form. And I just laid on my couch drooling and feeling so happy, so relaxed. You could have said you're going to die in 5 minutes. I would have been like, okay. I mean, it was just the most, I accepted everything as it was. I felt like I had never felt in my life, which was fully and completely with the world, even though I wasn't relaxed, happy, serene. And my mind was racing a mile a minute in what I thought was a creative way. And I kept a journal of my amazing thoughts. And then when I, a week later, when I wasn't on the Demerol anymore, I looked at it and I couldn't even read what I'd written. And I was like, no, those thoughts are lost to space and time. But I remember the doctor saying to me, listen, you need to take an extra day off work. You can't go back into work the day that you stop the Demerol. You're going to have, because you're not addicted, but you're going to have a little bit of an emotional withdrawal because you're not going to feel as good emotionally. Nobody would. And I did. I cried for a whole day. And then I went back to work. And I remember now looking back, I'm like, that's how they get you. It's these celebrities who have these sycophantic doctors and these, you know, who just want to be around them. And if I had been some famous, you know, like Michael Jackson, and I'm like, but I like that feeling. And all I would have had to do was say, well, what if I just have a little bit every day administered by you? Oh, okay. You know, that could have been, I could see where that would have gone. But since I had no access to it, and I got over it like a week later, you know, it wasn't like trying to, you know, well, there wasn't the internet. Well, there was, but only weirdos were on it at that point. I wasn't trying to look up Demerol on my roommate's AOL account. Anyway, there was one time I did drink too much in college and I blacked out and I woke up. I knew I was at a party and I know this sounds like a lie. I was at like a comedy party. It was like three comedy troupes at my college got together for a party. What fun. And one of the girls, her name was Julie, and she probably might be listening because we're still kind of friends. She made Jello shots and I'd never had one before. And I go, are these Jello shots? She goes, no, this is a batch without the alcohol in it, but the ones in the fridge have alcohol. So I go, oh, cool. And I just ate the ones without the alcohol in it. And then later she was like, I was kidding, you idiot. And so I had, that's like, I immediately blacked out. So I woke up and I was sitting on the couch next to Justin, who was literally like one of the hottest guys I'd ever seen. Like, imagine Johnny Depp mixed with, but we're like with blue eyes, like piercing blue eyes, but sort of looked like when John Travolta was hot during Welcome Back, Kotter, like just a beauty. And I was sitting next to him and I woke up and he went, "Oh, thank you. Thank you." And I was like, "What? What did I say?" And he goes, "You just told me I was hot and you have a crush on me." And go, "Oh my God." Now I probably could have made something happen, but I ran away assuming what would he like me for? But he was sitting there talking to me. So I don't know why I screwed up. I screwed up. And he was really hot, but he used to be fat in high school, Justin. And high school, you know, when you're in college, is only 2 years ago. It's not like 20 years ago. He wasn't over it yet, how fat he was in high school. He went to like a 7-person high school. So one time I'm in my, all the girls wanted Justin and he didn't have any of us. One time I'm in my room and he called my room and he was like, "Do you want to come over?" Which his room was like 7 doors down. I'm like, "Of course I do." So I come over and he's just sitting in a chair by himself and he goes, "Do you want to see this pair of jeans that I have?" And I go, "Sure." And he opens up a suitcase and he takes out this pair of jeans. It's like 6 sizes bigger than he is. And he goes, "I used to fit into these. Like sometimes they were tight." And I go, "Really? When?" He's like, "In high school, like, you know, a year and a half ago." I'm like, "Wow, you look great." And he's like, "Yeah." And then we just watched reruns of All in the Family in his room, like in chairs, not even like sitting on the bed together. And then, when I left, he goes, "Do you want those jeans?" And they wouldn't have fit me. I was tiny, but I go, "Why?" He goes, "I just don't want them in here. Maybe you can do something with them." And I was like, "Well, I don't know how to like sew." And he's like, "Oh," and I go, "Oh, I'll take them." So I just took his fat jeans and I would wear them around in my dorm room with like a huge belt on just to be like, "I have Justin's jeans." Then the next time I saw him after college was 2001, sometime in New York City. I was at a deli right next door to where I worked. And I walked in and I saw him. And my first thought was, "I can dump my boyfriend tonight. I'll dump my boyfriend. I'll dump my boyfriend if Justin and I rekindle." But it turned out he was like living in Japan with some woman and he was just back for a week. I'm like, "Oh, all right. You went Asian. I got it." Anyway, I don't know what that had to do with anything, but shout out to Justin. God, if I could tell my young self anything, is dudes would put their penis in a toilet paper roll. So don't be so hard on yourself, 19-year-old Jen. You sat next to Justin. You told him you thought he was hot and he didn't run away. You didn't have to run away. Maybe you could have at least kissed him and thrown up on him after the jello shots. Anyway, what's my point? Oh, so my point is I'm reading this article years ago in Vanity Fair on LSD. So I guess like in the 60s, like Cary Grant and his wife used to just take LSD because before Abbie Hoffman and all those dudes got hold of it, it was actually like a synthesized thing that was to stimulate the central nervous system. And so like in the 30s and in the 40s and in the 50s, psychiatrists use LSD to get patients to go to another level so they could just kind of almost re-experience their childhood. And Cary Grant's ex-wife was like, you know, just one of these, like, "I'm super rich. I'm super depressed. I don't know what it is." And she, it was like, you could have all the therapy in the world, but she needed that instant jarring feeling of change. And so she used to go to the psychiatrist's office and he would give her prescription LSD, these Beverly Hills psychiatrists, $100 a session. And the sessions would go from like 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. She returned to Hartman's office for her sessions and her LSD, arriving at 8 a.m. and sometimes staying until as late as 7 at night. Like a dentist leaving a patient after administering Novocaine, the psychiatrist was in and out of the room, sometimes putting on music to enhance the atmosphere. And I don't really know what would happen, but she would feel better. I don't really think I trust that the doctor just went in and out of the room. I feel like some weird stuff went on. But the one drug I do want to try is that, and I'm never going to, but I wish in a perfect atmosphere I could go back to the 50s and have LSD be what it used to be and have a doctor prescribe it and lay there and just get some kind of perfect with the universe feeling. Why don't you meditate? I know I do, but you know what I'm saying? I guess the new thing is ayahuasca that people do. They go in a desert and it's some kind of plant. I'm not doing any of this stuff, but here's my goal. I think when I'm like 60, right? My parents will be dead. Probably I can't disappoint them at that point. Well, they could be 98. I'll do LSD at a doctor's office. I'm sure at some point we'll regress back to the 50s and you'll go back to, you know, psychiatry won't work anymore because people can't pay attention and we'll have to regress back to going to LSD. But I think sitting in a doctor's office and having them give me, I'm still one of those idiots that thinks it's safe if it's from a doctor. Like if some like friend of mine on a bridge was like, let's do LSD and bond. I'd be like, are you crazy? But if a doctor was like, I'll do the same thing in my office, but there's a degree on the wall and there's central air. I'm like, well, this must be great. Anyway, I'm not really going to do that, but that's the only thing that interests me. Otherwise, you know, I'm good with a couple glasses of Pinot Grigio and God bless, I guess I don't have the, I don't have the itch. I think that's it. And really, what's more annoying than like, that's why I don't get about like doing shots and stuff. I'm like, why do you want to immediately get drunk and then feel sick? People always ask me at shows, can I buy you a shot? I'm like, you bought a ticket. That's all I want you to do. I don't want to do shots. I don't want to do anything. But you know, God, let people have fun. I'm the celibate, straight edge dork here, which I'm not straight edge or celibate, but you know what I'm saying? That part of me will never go away of just like feeling a little bit superior that I don't need to get, you know, all messed up all the time. Which is pretty stupid. Anyway. And my hangovers are too bad. I can't even drink a lot now. I do that drunk history. I did another one. It's coming out in July. You'll see it on Comedy Central. I had to leave 2 days to get over a hangover of 2 bottles of wine, which 2 bottles of wine is 8 glasses. And I drank it like over the course of 6 hours. It's a lot, but 2 days of hangover, that's ridiculous. Anyway, this is obviously the end of the podcast because I don't know what I'm talking about anymore. Mom, if you're out there, don't call and yell at me about drugs. Don't do LSD. I'm not. Oh, I take a little Klonopin when I fly, like a 0.5 milligram. But I don't ever want to abuse that because I need it for when I'm feeling anxious. If I ever took it for fun, then it wouldn't work when I'm anxious. And then I'm screwed because we will see Armageddon in our lifetime. And I always have to have enough Klonopin for Armageddon. That's just kind of how I look at things. You know, I'm a hoarder that way. Anyway, rest in peace, everybody. Len Bias, Jimi Hendrix. Shout out to all my old friends, Nikki, Angie, Justin. So here's what we're going to do this week. I'm going to be in Toronto, Canada, Friday, June 7th, Saturday, June 8th at the Comedy Bar. I have 3 shows, 1 Friday, 2 Saturday. Come out, come out, come out. I'm going to be at the Solid Sound Festival doing 2 shows. I will be doing a 45-minute set, I believe, and some banter with John Hodgman up front. That is Saturday, June, I told you, the 20-something-ith. Go to my website, Jen Kirkman, tour dates, June 22nd, Saturday. Then I've got some announcements coming up about July. There might be some announcements about another thing I'm doing as part of a festival. Can't say it yet. And then September, Austin, I'll be at the Scottish Rite Theater one night. Please come. I need 300 of you. The tickets are on sale now. Go to my website, jenkirkman.com, tour dates. Bloomington, Indiana in October. Can't wait for that one. Can't wait for everything. Wow, what a little chipper bird I am, huh? What a little Pollyanna. Anyway, buy my book, I Can Barely Take Care of Myself. It is not just for people who don't want kids. It's for people who want to hear all kinds of fun stories. What a great and specific review that is. Thank you. It's on Amazon.com. You can read reviews there. Skip the ones that say, I hate her. She's stupid. And I was just going to remind you that I have a new podcast, but you know that because you're listening to it. Why can't I get that straight? I'd like to thank everyone in Seattle and Portland who came to my shows. those were, every time I go anywhere, I'm like, that was my favorite, but those were my favorite shows. Everywhere I've gone, people have been so wonderful. They bring me gifts. They bring me coffee. They bring me interesting spiced liquors that are made from the area, food, jewelry. It is so lovely. And it just melts my heart and makes me feel so good. And I love everyone that came to the shows in Seattle and Portland. I was so overwhelmed that Seattle sold out and Portland was close to full and was full, but close to sold out. I mean, it was just so wonderful. I know there are many comedy choices. Thank you for choosing me on those specific nights. So I love you all. And until next week, have fun.
Ugliest thing. I don't know what keeps me alive and kicking. I know the meaning of life, it doesn't help me a bit.